There we go. Okay. Mourning during the Omer. Now, if you were to ask the average person, I understand that Jews don't have weddings during this period, and that they avoid doing music, whatever it might be. Why do you behave that way? What would your answer be? Somebody comes up to you and says, why is it that you guys don't have weddings and have these other practices during this period? How come some of you guys look kind of scruffy right now?
Crusades?
What?
The Crusades?
The Crusades. How many people would actually give that answer?
Probably the right one. Right?
But I would by the way, I'm gonna challenge you on that, because then Sephardim should have no mourning whatsoever. they should be having weddings and parties and everything else right now.
Does it relate to Rabbi Akiva died in June?
Talmid of Rabbi Akiva, good. That's the stock answer. Dovi, you're already ahead of the game, but that's the stock answer. And let's take a look at it. Now, normally we do things top down. We always start from the earliest sources and move ahead. And we're going to do that for the most part. But we're going to start today with a little bit of a later source, early medieval source, that's going to spring us back to the original source. I'll show you what I mean. The practice of abstention, I'm not going to call it mourning because I don't know what it is, but I know that there's an abstention from weddings. It was practiced at some point in history in some communities from sometime around Pesach till sometime around Shavuot. I'm being deliberately vague about it for reasons that will become apparent pretty soon. This practice does not show up in any form that we have, any written form that we have, until the 10th century. And what you're looking at in source one is a quote, a piece from the Sha'arei Simcha of Rabbi Yitzchak Ibn Gayat, a 10th century Spanish Chacham, who was the very, very beginning sort of Spanish scholarship. And Maharitz Gayat, in his book, mentions this custom, but he actually mentions it from the sort of opposite direction you would expect. You would expect that he's coming to tell you, you know what, we really shouldn't have weddings now. You'll see that it's a little bit more nuanced than that. Here, take a look. Minhag b'chol Yisrael. He makes two statements here that are not so clear, as we'll see. Although he makes them clearly, it is a custom throughout Israel, meaning all Jewish people, shelo lisa ben Pesach la'atzeret, to not have weddings between Pesach and Shavuot. As we will see, it is not a custom throughout all of Israel, and the time period is also not throughout all of Israel. We'll see that later on. And then he says, "Umishum avelutu velo mishum isur." He says the reason is because of mourning and not because of a prohibition. Now, what does he mean by that? So he's clearly commenting on someone else's observation or someone else's suggestion that there's a prohibition to get married. He says, no, it's not a prohibition, it's mourning. Which means that whoever else made that suggestion wasn't connecting it with any sort of mourning practice, but was saying there's some sort of a halachic prohibition against having weddings now. He says, not the case. Shekach amru chachamim, and then he quotes the story, and we're going to look at the story next. I'll just quickly mention it, the story of the death of Rabbi Akiva's students. And then he says, umeotash sha'ah. From that point on, now, by the way, when did Rabbi Akiva's students live? And more importantly, when did they die? In the early part of the second century. This is, we're hearing about for the first time in the 10th century. And he says, from that moment on, Nahaguli Tabel Alehen, the custom was to mourn for these students. Shaloli sa isha bimim halalu. And how do we mourn? By not having weddings. Now, there's a whole lot of strange things in that statement. But the most obvious strange thing is, well, if from the second century till now, the 10th century, there has been a universal Jewish custom to not have weddings now and to mourn for these students, how come nobody ever said anything about it? How come it doesn't show up in the Gemara? How come it doesn't show up in the works of the early Gaonim? Nobody says anything. So that's the silence is kind of deafening. But there are other problems here, which we're going to talk about when we look at the story itself. V'davka nisu'in she'ikar simcha b'chupa. He says, it's only actually the marriage that's the problem, because that's when the happiness is. Ubiknisa, when you come into the chupa, aval la'aretz l'kadesh lo, just kiddushin, that's fine. And Nisui Nami, even marriage itself. Misha Kafats Vikines Einun Sinotov. Somebody goes ahead and has a wedding now. Nobody, there's no consequences. There's no punishment, right? El Aval Im Bali Shaol Lachatrila, if he says, when should I have my wedding? Maureen Lo Shalos. They would tell him, don't do it now. Shaloli Stormi Nag Yisrael. So you don't go against the common minig. V'cheno Ruah Gonim. It says that this is how the Gonim, and by the way, as I mentioned, as I have in the header here, a parallel comment, almost the same, shows up in Shuvot HaGonim, also from the 10th century. So again, it's it is from that period. So the question is, he makes a statement which you will see the evidence is not a valid statement, meaning it's not true that it is a custom throughout all of Israel, and it's not true that it is from Pesach to Shavuot everywhere. But the biggest problem is to say that this is a custom of mourning that goes back to the times of Rabbi Akiva's students. So let's start with actually seeing the story of Rabbi Akiva's students that we're talking about. Shall we say?
Yes.
Let's take a look at one version of the story of Rabbi Akiva's students. And time permitting today, and if not the next week, we're going to see three other versions of that story. Okay, Sam.
Yeah, first of all, we've had all kinds of terrible things happen, crusades and other things.
Yeah, agreed.
Wait a second. And we like to push it on to Tisha B'Av.
Right.
The question is, why didn't we push it on to Tisha B'Av?
Agreed.
Especially, agreed. This is a time when we're anticipating receiving the Torah. It should be a time, there's even more reason not to do it now.
Okay, fine. Agreed. This is a problematic statement, associating it with this, and we'll get to there. It's going to take us a while to get to where this is, and I'm not promising a panacea. I'm not going to say at the end I'm going to come up with some magical answer to this, but I want to point out the problems. And you're absolutely right, Sam, that other events that have happened through history, either we mourn for them on the spot, and then after a while we sort of forget about them because other things come along, or we collapse them into Tisha B'Av. You're absolutely right. Okay, so let's now see the story of Rabbi Akiva's students and keep that in the background. Your questions are good questions. The whole discussion in the Talmud starts in Masachet Yevamot. And you wonder, what is it doing in Masachet Yevamot? So we have to go through a little bit of a twisty piece. Masachet Yevamot is about Yibum. And Yibum is driven by one consideration, and that consideration is having children. A man died, never had children, who outlived him. And his name is going to be lost. And therefore, if he was married and one of his brothers, if he has a brother, all sorts of conditions, who that brother is, who the wife is, etc. He should marry the wife and have a kid, and that kid will carry on the name. Very good. So in the context of Yevamot, the mitzvah of Pur Urvu is examined. And we have the following statement about Pur Urvu at the end of the sixth chapter of Yevamot. And you have it here with English. Loi batel adam mipirya urvia. A person should not ignore or neglect the mitzvah of piriya urvia. Ela imken yeshlo banim, meaning if you already had kids, you don't have to have more kids. And if you already had kids and you're no longer married, you don't have to get married again. Right? But as long as you already did your mitzvah, what's the mitzvah? So every mitzvah has its parameters. What's the parameter of a lulav? Mitzvachim hai. How was the parameter of hadasim? Nefti mishulash. What's the parameter of puravu? Beit Shammai Omrim Shnei Zacharim. The parameter is two sons. Beit Hillel Omrim Zachar Unukeva. Beit Hillel say, no, a boy and a girl, and he quotes a pasuk. Right. I'm not concerned with what this is about because this is just a springboard. But notice that Beit Hillel Beit Shammai will be very happy if you have two boys and a girl. Then everybody's covered. Right? But that's it. Which means, by the way, according to the rule in this Mishnah, and I'm going to make it now happy for everybody, you have two boys, you have a girl, you can now take a break. You can, you don't have to remarry if you're not married. You don't have to have more kids than your family. It doesn't matter. You're done. Okay. The Gemara then comments on that and says that this Mishnah does not accord with the opinion of Rabbi Yehoshua, which, by the way, is pretty interesting because Rabbi Yehoshua was a student of Beit Hillel. So it means one of two things. It either means that we're actually going to expand things a little bit, which is probably what's happening, or it could mean that there was a Tana who had a version of Beit Hillel Beit Shammai, and Rabbi Yeshua, being a student of Beit Hillel, says, no, it's not so. That's not what they agreed on. They didn't agree on that. All right, either way, what does Rabbi Yeshua say? Nasa Adam Isha Beyalduto, Yisa Isha Beziknuto. All right. So if a man was married when he was young, he should marry again when he's older. Now, this does not mean for one second that if a man gets married when he's 20 and he lives for the next 20 years with his wife, and his wife is now Nebuch 40, so he should divorce her and marry another 20-year-old. It doesn't mean that. What it means is if a man got married when he was younger and now he finds himself older and without a wife, she died, they got divorced, then he should marry again. In other words, don't live alone. Hayulo banim bialduto, and this is the part that hits home, if he had sons when he was young, yulo banim bezignuto, he should have more sons when he's older. Shenemar, and he quotes a pasuk, and this pasuk is in Kohelet, and in Kohelet chapter 11, the pasuk, which seems to be directed to farmers, says, or metaphorically, in the morning, plant your seeds. Don't stop in the evening. Now, you would think that the reason a farmer would want to be diligent and not lazy and keep planting is because the more you plant, the more it grows. And you would think the same thing with kids. You would think, oh, have more kids because the more kids, the better. That's not the reason given. You don't know which plants are going to actually work. This one or that one. You plant two rows. Row one might get wiped out. So you have row two to back it up. And if they both work out, that's even better. So what does Rabbi Yeshua seem to be saying? If you had kids when you're younger, have more kids when you're older, because you don't know what's going to happen to that first group of kids. That means the first group of kids could turn out to be killed. Or the first group of kids could turn out to be sick, or that first group of kids could turn out to be bums. All right. And by the way, I know, and you guys may know some families that have two generations of kids. There's kids that the couple had when they were first married, and then for some reason they took a break of a few years, and then they have more kids, and it's almost like two different families. I'm not saying better or worse, but kind of different.
Yes. Yeah. Did this come up a lot in World War II when people's families?
Yeah. So I'm going to tell you a story, which is a story about this exact thing, which happened to me, sort of, meaning somebody that I knew. When I first came to Keren Biavne, there was a fellow there who was a couple years older than I was. I think he was 20 at the time, who was like off the charts genius. And everybody was talking about him as the next Rosh Hashiva here and there and the other. And the guy was truly a brainiac. And I found out that his father was also a Rav from Europe. And so I assumed, in my very youthful pigeonholing attitude, that he probably had 10 brothers and sisters, and et cetera. And I also found out that his father was a Rav in a shul in Yerushalayim, right near where my aunt lived. So I would, in those years, I would go to my aunt for Shabbos sometimes. So I went, and then I'd go to his shul for Shalos Seudos to meet him. And I saw this very old man. I said, wait a second, this guy's like only a year older than I am. And this guy looks like his grandfather. And so I asked around a little bit, and I found out he didn't have a lot of siblings. He had one sibling. He had one sibling who was a sister who was 30 years older than he was. So long story short, I found out what happened. This father of his was a Rav in Europe, a big Dayan, big Talmud Chacham, who had 8 kids, and his family was butchered by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam. And he survived, and his daughter survived. He and his daughter survived, and they came to Israel. So he did what Rabbi Yeshua said. He got married again, married a younger woman, and had a kid. And that kid was my friend. Right? So, yes, we see it. And, yes, World War II had some of this, but it's been throughout history. Okay. Rabbi Akiva, who, by the way, important to note, is Rabbi Yeshua's student, Omer, Lamad Torah b'yalduto, yilmod Torah b'ziknuto. If you studied Torah when you're young, study again when you're older. That doesn't mean again. It means keep studying when you're older. You don't turn around and say, I already did my Torah. I want to do something else. You continue studying. Now, you'll see the parallel. Hayulo talmidim b'yalduto, yulo talmidim b'ziknuto. If you had students when you're young, have more students when you're older. So you see the parallel between getting married and studying Torah, and having children and having students. So it's like Rabbi Kiva is sort of taking Rabbi Yeshua's lesson and turning it into from biological family to the educational family or the spiritual family. Shenemar, same pasuk, babokez ratzarecha. Okay. Now, a question I want to pose to you is, when did Rabbi Akiva say this? Meaning, at what point in his life did he make this observation? Let's keep going. Amru. So now they tell a story. What's the story? 12,000 zugim talmidim. By the way, this is a strange number. 12,000 pairs of students. It's a strange number because the Gemara knows how to multiply and how to say 24,000. Why doesn't it say 12,000 pairs of students? All right, so we'll see. Hayulo the Rabbi Akiva. He had 12,000 pairs of students. And I know the first thing you're going to say is they were chavrusas. The problem is the chavrusa system didn't exist yet. So not so clear. Migvat var Antipras. So Gvat, which may be near Akko and may be for in the south. Antipras, we know, is near Netanya. But in that region, he had all of these thousands of students. V'chulan metu b'perek echad. They all died at one shot, meaning during one period. Mipnei shelo nahagu kavod zel hazeh. Why did they die? Because they didn't treat each other nicely. They were disrespectful to each other. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that on the toe tag it said disrespect? You check the chart. It said cause of death, lack of respect. Is that what it means? So clearly it doesn't mean that. Clearly it means they died of something that you can see as a normal cause of death. They got killed. They had a disease, whatever it is. But underlying this clearly unnatural wipeout of so many thousands of students of one man in one short period, there's a spiritual reason behind it. And the spiritual reason is the way they treated each other. Now, you got to really stop and ask a question. These are Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. All right, so let's say you are a Talmid of Rabbi Akiva, and you're, of course, on the baseball team. All right, Robert, you play third base on the baseball team. Now, Robert, what does it say in your uniform? You play for the Rabbi Akiva school. So what does it say? So in front, it says the Akavites. I don't know. On the back, it says Smith, 42, because everybody's got to have 42 these days. And on the side, what does it say on the elbow, on the shoulder? There's a logo. You know what it says on the logo? Love your neighbor as yourself. That's the rule of the Torah. And a big iron in the middle, and, you know, don't mess with us. Rabbi Akiva is the man who said the standard of Torah is love your neighbor as yourself. And here we have thousands of students from Akiva who are all accused of the way they treat each other being so bad, that it's so bad that they got killed for it. Something to think about. Just put all these questions in the hopper and we'll get to it. Vaya ha'olam shamein. The world was desolate. Now, what world are we talking about? We're not talking about the world of finance or the world of commerce. We're talking about the world of Torah. The world of Torah was desolate. Now, this is a little bit of a strange phrase because desolate makes it sound like there is nobody left who's studying Torah. Because Rabbi Akiva's students all died, and they were the whole Torah. Rabbi Akiva is now alone with nobody to teach. The world's desolate. It's not exactly the case, because look at the next line. Ad Sheba Rabbi Akiva Eitzel Rabotenu Sheba Darom. And then Rabbi Akiva then came to our teachers who were in the south, which means there were people in the south of Israel teaching Torah at the time. The world wasn't so desolate. So the whole story is not hanging together very well. And who are these great teachers? Ushnaalem, Rabbi Akiva then taught them, but they're already called Rabotenu. They're not called young students. And who are they? Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Shimon. By the way, that foursome is the quartet of the Mishnah. That foursome, those names show up more than any other names in the Mishnah, more than any other names in the Midrashei Tanaim. Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon, they are it. And they are all students of Rabbi Akiva from his latter years. Rabbi Shimon, by the way, is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Right? Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. Right? There are different versions of this list, but all versions of this list include those four. Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua is number five on this list. And then there's a very weird line here, which is, they are the ones who raised up Torah at that moment. I'm not sure exactly what that line means, or we'll talk about it. But it sounds like the intent is that they kind of brought Torah, they revived Torah, these great students. Okay, that's the Braita. All right, so let's just talk about this Braita for a second. We hear a story that Rabbi Akiva had all of these students, and they all died at one time because they behaved badly. How are we supposed to react to this event? We read the story. How are we supposed to react to this event? What do you think? Just hit your space bar and you can talk.
I think it's a tragedy. They didn't learn.
But how
didn't learn Rabbi Akiva's basic premise.
So how are we supposed to react? That's the question.
Sad. Supposed to be sad.
And again?
You have to be sad.
Why am I sad? What am I sad about?
Something like this could happen.
Yeah. So Dovi asked an interesting question. It's a technical question here, which we're going to get back to, but not today, which is Botoperek. What's Otoperek as opposed to Otasha'a? So a really quick answer is Otasha'a would really mean like in one day. Otoperek could mean a few months. The perek was mine, right? And that's the Lashon and Psachim Kufi Zayin, Al-Koperek. But we might be sad, but what are we sad for in hearing this story? Are we sad for the death of these students? Or are we sad for their behavior that led to their death? I don't know. But
you could also tell us we don't understand God's justice, especially the two sons of Aaron. These people, they're learning Torah anyway, even if they weren't perfect. They didn't do anything to deserve a death penalty.
Okay, but these guys evidently did. Another one of you, we don't understand it. And we've got lots of different ways to look at it. And they could have been the holiest people around. Moshe said to Aaron in one midrash, I thought you or I would be the korban. Turns out they're greater than we are. Could be a lot of things. I don't know.
It sounds like we should be sad about the fact that there was no Torah in the world until the others, the rabbis, were taught again.
Okay, so that's another thing, is that maybe we should sad. What's Dovi, you got to tell me in a second what you mean. It could be that we're sad because of the dearth of Torah that happened for however long. We don't know how long it was. Was it 5 minutes after the last guy was buried and then Rabbi Akiva found new students? Was it a year? Was it? We don't know in this story. Okay,
what deserves a death penalty? What law in the Torah?
I don't know. I'm just reading the story. I don't know. I'm just asking, how are we supposed to react to this story?
Well, the Gemara is mostly concerned with Rabbi Akiva's reaction to it and how it's a kilum of this this teaching to move on and to recreate your Torah family.
So okay, good. So I'm going to now ask you two questions which are related and going to touch them with what Dovi just said. When did Rabbi Akiva come up with the observation that the pasuk that his teacher used about having kids could be applied to students? Maybe it was now. In other words, maybe his observation was the result of his life, that he had students and he thought, I have all these students, it's great. And then they all died and they turned around and said, you know what? Maybe you have to have more students. Maybe what my teacher taught about kids, I should apply to students. And now I'm going to add to that. Try out this scenario. Rabbi Akiva has thousands of students and he's teaching them Nega'im and Ohalot, the details of Tumah V'Tahara, all of the intricate things. And they behave badly. And as a result of them behaving badly, they die. And Rabbi Akiva turns around and says, you know what? I missed the mark. What should I have been teaching them? In other words, maybe V'ahavta l'recha kamocha zekal gadol v'torah is something Rabbi Akiva said now. See, our problem is we read something that a great chacham said, and we assume he came out of the womb saying that. We assume the Rambam came out of the womb with three books under his arms, the Mishnah Torah, the Perush Mishnayot, and Sefer Mitzvah. You know, and the Mora Nevuchim in the back of his head. No, he came out a baby. Maybe Rabbi Akiva came to this observation after this terrible tragedy. So just something to think about. I want to finish the story itself the way it's presented. Now, we finished the story. We have now a separate brayta that says, Tana kula meitu mipesach v'aratzeret. There's a separate story that says that this terrible event happened between Pesach and Shavuot. And by the way, Pesach and Shavuot, we assume that means in the same year, as opposed to Pesach 1 year and Shavuot 3 years later. Okay, fine. So Pesach and Shavuot. So that's a pretty condensed period of time, 7 weeks, for so many thousands of people to die and young men to die. And then we get a much later tradition in Bavel. Amar Rav Chama bar Abba v'temer Rav Chiya bar Avin, kulam metu mita ra'a. They all died a bad death. By the way, in some of the Kitvei Yad, it reads, metu mita mishuna. Mishuna means a very unusual death, unusual in the sense of cruelty. And mahi, so now we have a later tradition, Amar Rav Nachman askara. They died from diphtheria, which is evidently something where you choke and you can't breathe. It's very, very painful. Okay. I mean, not okay, very sad. But we have lots of questions about this story. One of the questions about the story is 24,000 students. I mean, come on, that sounds a little bit much. And why are they presented as 12,000 pairs? And
does that have anything to do with the rebellion?
But the biggest question you want to ask here is, how are we supposed to react to this? So you're telling me that our reaction is, during the entire time that they were dying, we should be mourning. And so I'm going to ask you three questions. And with those three questions, we're going to take a pause till next week. Question number one, for whom do we mourn in halakha? For whom do we mourn? The answer is only close relatives. That's it. I don't know who these guys are. Second of all, what's the longest period of mourning that exists in halakha? From the moment of the tragedy until the end of mourning, what's the longest you could ever have?
12 months.
That's it. You can never go more than 12 months. And here we're talking about close to 2,000 years, maybe about 1,900 years from an event. And third question is, what's the period of mourning in halakha? What periods of mourning do we have? We have a day. We have 3 days, we have 7 days, we have 30 days, we have 12 months. We don't have 7 weeks, it doesn't exist. And we don't ever in mourning associate the length of mourning with the length of the tragedy. We don't say, oh, this guy was in critical condition for 2 weeks and then he died, so I'm gonna mourn for 2 weeks. We don't say this guy was held hostage by Hezbollah for 3 weeks and he was killed, so we're gonna mourn for 3 weeks. Our mourning doesn't correlate with the pain, with the period of tragedy. The tragedy is the tragedy, and mourning has its own system. But the biggest question, of course, is where is there any mention in this sugya that says, and as a result of this event, we mourn, we desist from weddings, we whatever. You notice it's not here. And by the way, what we'll see next week is we're going to see three other versions in rabbinic literature of this story. And I'm telling you right ahead, in not one of them is a mention of any sort of practice that we have as a result of this. Which means we got two things we got to do over the course of next week and maybe the week after. One of them is we got to figure out where mourning during this period comes from. And we have a lot of different sources to discuss. And the second thing we got to do, I'm not sure what order we're going to do it in, we'll see, is to look at this story and see what is up with the story and where the story came from and how the story developed. All right? So that's what we're going to do over the course of the next 2 weeks. Okay?
Yes, I have a different. Can I just give you one different take on this?
Sure.
If Beit Hillel says that Pur Vu requires a male child and a female child,
right?
And Rabbi Akiva said this is referring to Torah and disciples and students. Sounds to me that what Rabbi Akiva is really saying is that we should have both male and female rabbis.
Okay, so this is what happens when you have an agenda. When you have an agenda, you don't read text straight. I know you're kidding. Is that when you have an agenda, you don't read text straight. What did Rabbi Hillel say? I'm going to take you on. What did Beit Hillel say? Pur Vu is a boy and a girl. He gets it from Pasuk. Beit Shammai says it's two boys. He gets it from his Pasuk from Moshe. I think Gemara deals with it. Rabbi Yeshua comes along later and says, no, there is no limit. There's no such thing as saying I have enough kids. Have as many kids as you can because you don't know what's going to happen to them. Rabbi Akiva then takes that lesson and applies it to students. Have as many students as you can. Doesn't say as many rabbis as you can. One is usually way more than enough. So in any case, I'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
And we'll go from there.